this fear of being a failure, it's a very strong fear. It's historical. It's not a fear that has been present just one day or, you know, in their adult life. It's courageous to walk with a mind that is prone to deeply care and knowing that the world will disappoint us, knowing that we will disappoint others. I think self-compassion skills are extremely important in our life, but in particular in those moments when we're grieving the gap between how things are supposed to be or we want them to be and how things are.
That was Dr. Z, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Patricia Zurita Ona, or Dr. Z as she is commonly known. She is a clinical psychologist specializing in children, adolescents, and adults struggling with OCD, anxiety, and emotion regulation problems. Dr. Z is the founder of East Bay Behavior Therapy Center, a therapy practice where she runs an intensive outpatient program integrating acceptance and commitment therapy and exposure and response prevention. She is the creator of Act Beyond OCD, an online class for people that want to augment their ACT and ERP skills for tackling OCD. In addition to her clinical work, Dr. Z supervises and teaches doctoral students at the Wright Institute, a private graduate school for psychology. She has also authored several books and workbooks, which I can leave links for below. Some of the topics we explore in this episode include the importance of behavioral flexibility in the face of adversity, the difference between harmonious passions and obsessive behaviors, how perfectionism can show up in a range of life areas, common challenges related to decision-making, regret, and the fear of failure, how a connection to a deeper awareness can help us move through difficulty, and the role of psychedelic-assisted therapy in cultivating an observer self. So great talking to Dr. Z. This was her second time on the podcast. If you haven't heard the first one, it was great talking to her then. You can check that out. This was a cool one where there wasn't any real plan going in or specific book or topic to talk about. And we just kind of followed the moment and it was really great. And thanks for all being here and listening again. I know it's been a while since the last episode. If it helps, a lot of life has happened for me. I've got married. I created an ACT training that I'll be putting on for the first time in Raleigh, North Carolina this upcoming weekend. We went to Costa Rica. Oh yeah, a lot of stuff has happened, but I'm here and committed to continuing to do these. So thanks again. All right, well, let's get into the podcast episode with Dr. Z. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's been a while. Welcome back. Life has been very full, but good. Yeah, I'm talking to you here from a new office since we last, I don't know if it's since we last talked, but I moved back to our home state of Connecticut and I'm building up a practice here with the same sort of group I was working with down in North Carolina. So anyway, it's been a very full year.
That's really sweet. That's really a big move, right? How does it feel home to you right now when you are in Connecticut?
Yeah, it's definitely better this time of year. If you asked me, 5 months ago in the middle of winter, I might have different answers. But
I know how it goes. But that is a really sweet move. And I think I saw on Instagram that you got engaged, and I see pictures of your puppy too.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's right. We're friends on there, so you get a little behind the scenes. But yeah, getting married this summer soon, you know.
Wow. Congratulations. Such a special transition in life, right?
Yeah, it is. It is special. So I appreciate that. What about you? What's the past year been like for you?
You know, I think 2022 and beginning of 23 were definitely lighter months for me. I didn't have any project after project, as I usually have been having the last couple of years. I was trying to figure out, you know, my next move, and I took some time to just think more about it. So that was good. It was a different experience, right? It was a different experience to just be chill, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to just figure out the next thing. And then 3 months ago, I injured my knee. I usually go for long bike rides. It's like really, really like my thing. I love doing it. And one of those days, I ended up having a lot of pain on my knee. And turns out that I injured my meniscus. So that has been also a very interesting stage because, you know, I like to exercise. It really, you know, keeps me healthy, cleans my head, right? I think that I'm a big proponent that we have to be moving our body in some form, in some shape. So this has been the longest time, 3 months, in which I have limited ability to exercise, right? I cannot go for hikes. I cannot go for, you know, runs. I cannot ride my bike, definitely. So that has been really interesting, noticing the struggle, right, of wanting something, the disappointment, and thinking about what's doable without losing myself on that. So that was interesting, a new experience for me.
Wow, yeah, I totally get that. Well, sorry about the injury, but it sounds like it gives you one thing it's offered is an opportunity to just recognize how important certain things are for you and have to sort of sit with the discomfort that comes with not being able to do that. You know, when I was talking to Steve Hayes the second time, we were talking about the idea of how as life changes, whether we get older, we have injuries or major life changes, sometimes the way that we typically acted on a certain value, that specific behavior goes away as an option, and we have to learn how to sort of evolve how we tap into our values in new ways. I guess like physical activity is one of those that might be harder when there's these like real physical limitations on how we can engage with our body, but I'm sure there's still opportunities there. Anyway, a little side rant, but it just made me remember that conversation.
No, but it does make sense, because what has been coming to me is the notion of behavioral flexibility, right? Like, I think we need to have some form of psychological flexibility to adapt and to adjust, right? Yeah. Like these days when I go to the gym, right, I have this urge, like, but I want to ride a bike, I want to run a little bit, right? And have to sit with that, but also adjust to what my body can do these days, what is doable without pushing myself into burning out zones, right? So I think that there is a lot of psychological skills that kick in this moment in which I have limited mobility. Not ideal. It's a reality slap because life brought this to me. I didn't choose this, right? Here I am just navigating to that to the best I can. But I think in terms of behavioral flexibility, making room for the disappointment, the frustration, the sadness that comes, or when you hold with white knuckles to the things that you were able to do before the injury and what you can do now, there is also that comparison that kicks in, right? So I think there is a lot to say about how to use ACT processes in moments like this. To me, it has been an unexpected moment in my life in which my goodness for ACT skills, right? So it's a lot of adjusting.
Yeah, totally. There's like sort of like the harmony that you can move how you live your life and express your values depending on whatever context your life is in, because like you, I love biking, and we might have talked about this last time, but you know, when I was in my earlier 20s, I biked so much and did all these long distance bike rides, and I'd go out for hours and ride bikes. And you know, ever since now having a dog, it's been hard for me to do that, because every time I'm out for a few hours, I know my dog's sitting home and he would love to be doing something. So I've adapted ever since having a dog, and I don't bike as much, but I go for a lot more hikes. And so being able to see the common denominator in biking and and hiking as just being in my body, being in nature, being present, and being able to adjust that that form of that value has been really cool, where I'm not just like resenting that I don't get to bike as much anymore.
Yeah, that's really cool, right? Because I think what also happens when you radically accept what is, not how you hope things will be, is that you also open yourself to have new experiences. Like these days, I'm taking classes that I haven't taken before. I'm working a lot upper body. I'm doing different types of yoga, right? So there is something to say that it can be liberating when you really accept what is in front of you and you're open to the new experience without any agendas to how it's supposed to be, right? And as you were talking, the other construct that came to my mind is the difference between harmonious passions and obsessive passions. Mm. In positive psychology, they have talked a lot about this, right? An obsessive passion will be like, no matter how much my knee is hurting, no matter the doctor's recommendation, I still push myself to go for a bike ride, right? Because I want to do it, because I have to do it, and I am ignoring the context of my body. A harmonious passion is more like dancing and finding the rhythm between what your body is able of doing or capable of doing and the context you are in, right? So, which is a little bit what you are describing, right? You're still going for bike rides, but that is also a harmonious passion because then you're thinking, okay, I have to go back home for the puppy. So you may adjust some of the bike rides. Yeah. So it's really interesting to look at this, you know, how these psychological concepts come into life in our day-to-day experiences.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I don't know if there's any clear boxes between that, but it is an interesting concept around what's like an like when things are obsessive versus like helpful. Because when we look at from the outside, so many people who achieve great things or succeed at a high level in one dimension or another, you know, the way they might relate to that part of their life can be really obsessive, but maybe was valuable to them, although maybe it kind of throws life off balance because we don't know the behind the scenes of everyone in their lives. So it's kind of an interesting concept, right? Like, when does something become a helpful passion versus an obsession?
And I agree with you. I don't think we have these very well-defined boxes, but I think, you know, and you see this a lot with high achievers, people that engage in striving actions or perfectionistic behaviors, that I think it's important to step back and check what's the motivation behind those behaviors, right? Are you chasing something? Are you chasing a rule that you must, you ought, you need to? Are you avoiding the fear of feeling like a failure? Mm-hmm. Or are you chasing something that is revitalizing and engaging, right? So I think it can be, they may look the same on the outside, right? Like in our example, going for a bike ride. But the question behind is, what is really driving this? What do you really, you know, want to go when you're going for a bike ride? What are you chasing here? So I think checking a little bit the experience of what drives this behavior is important.
Mm. Yeah. I think you do end up thinking about these topics a lot, right? And helping people with it. And you've developed programs around like high achieving. There's kind of this way that like pursuing achievement and perfectionism and obsessive patterns like merge that you've had an interest in your work, right?
Yeah. I think over the years, right, my work is primarily focused on ACT for anxiety-based struggles, right? And when I think about anxiety-based struggles, I'm thinking about OCD, social phobia, productivity anxiety, but also perfectionism, procrastination. And I think when I think of my clients and when I think of my own life, I think we travel with a collection of fears, right? It's not just one fear in isolation. I think our fears evolve and morph in our life. And I think that when working with procrastination, many times I have clients with social perfectionists, with moral perfectionists. They have been trying to excel and achieve in different areas of their life, right? And they may have social anxiety, but they are dealing with moral perfectionists, trying to do everything, you know, very according to the T, according to the ethics. So I think it was important for me to show how ACT can be extremely helpful for those struggles as well.
Can you say more about those two things, what that looks like for people? What's like social perfectionism. What does that look like?
Yeah. Just as a background, when I think about perfectionism, I'm thinking more like a construct, right? It's the outcome of and a strong fear of being a failure, and a strong attachment to rules about how things are supposed to be, and a strong over-identification with my accomplishments. And these three processes can show up in different areas of our life, can show up in my friendships. I need to be the best friend possible I can be. I need to always show up to my friends. If my friend asks me for help, I can never say no. I always have to say yes. If my friend asks me to do something I don't want to do, I cannot tell them because they may get upset, so I have to say yes. If you think about social situations, I have to make sure I never have a social mishap. If there is awkward silence in the conversation, I have to say something about it. I need to always say something funny so people think of me with a laugh and they like me, right? I think what you have is that if people are struggling with a fear of being a failure in a social situation, when practicing sports, in how they relate to their body, and they have a strong attachment to rules, and they are overly identified with that, you know, the outcome of situations, that is going to affect different areas of their life. And I think that's what happened when we think about how achievements and striving behaviors or perfectionistic actions, they are not exclusive to career or academic settings. They can be in every single area of our life, right? Because when you deeply care about things, of course you want to get things right and perfectly. But sometimes we may try to do things right and perfectly, and we also lose ourselves in that process.
Yeah, there seems to be, what showed up for me when you're saying that, there seems to be a lot of overlap with the pattern that we like often call people pleasing.
Yeah. That will be one area, right? That's exactly when they're like people pleasing behaviors, placating behaviors can be a form of perfectionistic actions. Because I'm afraid of rejection, because I'm afraid of saying no to people, and because I'm also holding with white knuckles onto rules about how I'm supposed to be, right? And think about that when we think about eating struggles, how we relate to our body. That can be another area in which perfectionism is showing up. Or how we're living our spiritual life, or how we're relating to sports, right? What happens in our lives when we all the time we're following rules? We're going to do more and more. We're working harder and harder, but somehow it never feels enough. We're chasing something that is unattainable in some way, right? So that's why I think sometimes perfectionism goes unchecked, right? It is socially reinforced, but also we may appreciate the friend that always show up to us, the friend that is always there for us, the friend that never says no. But we don't see that perhaps that is a person that is struggling with some form of the perfectionistic behaviors in a social setting, like social perfectionism.
This seems to be almost ubiquitous. This is something that most people experience kind of on a spectrum, which really fits into more of the transdiagnostic ACT lens that, you know, this isn't either something you have or you don't, but I think a lot of people struggle with this, even just based on how the mind functions in very sort of black and white ways. We can so easy to fall into these traps of ideas that we either do things right or wrong, and it can kind of fuel this very polarizing way of viewing ourselves and the world and others.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. So when I was working in the book on ACT for Perfectionists, one of the things that it was always in the back of my mind is the feedback that I hear from many of my clients and my own experience. Every client I work with, from the teenager to the person in their mid-20s, mid-30s, mid-40s, mid-50s, they all have received messages that says, you have to drop your standards, you're working so hard, just let it go. And they all, you know, felt so alienated by those messages. And I definitely, in my own life, you know, as an immigrant, as a woman, as a person that works hard, as a person that, you know, wants to write, of course I have received those messages too, right? Patricia, don't work so hard. The challenge is that the frame that I discovered with my clients and the frame that I used to collaborate with them is that When you deeply care, of course you want to get things right and perfectly. And we have, you know, many forms of that, right? You can deeply care about your friendship. You can deeply care about your career. You can deeply care about disseminating acting skills to the world. Mm-hmm. You can deeply care about your health. So of course you want to do things right and perfectly. But with that, it becomes a matter of discrimination. When you have to give your best, in which areas of your life, at what time in your life, and when you are willing to do the good enough job that gets you moving, right? So I think I agree with what you're saying, that these classifications that says right or wrong, or you shouldn't do it, or we should drop, you know, these preferential behaviors, they don't work. People know that. In fact, you know, clients are not lost. They have a strong attunement with their values. They know what matters.
Yeah.
It just happens they're holding onto their values rigidly and not flexibly, right? So part of the work with my clients and also in my own life has been to learn to discriminate, right? To flexibly dance when you just have to give your best and when you have to make a good enough choice to get your things moving.
Yeah.
But that's not easy, right?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like I notice for me, it's like I'll be almost automatically thrown into giving like 100% of everything that I'm doing. And then I have to be aware of when that's happening and not just force myself to pull back, but at least understand the greater sort of gestalt of life, that the more you push at 100% at all these different things, it's going to be taken away somewhere else. And so it's not that you can't give 110%. It's just being aware of the trade-offs in life, you know, or, you know, I'll find this even when I play in a slow pitch softball league, and I grew up playing baseball and I was competitive and I loved it. And I'll find myself out on the field in slow pitch community co-ed softball, like, you know, tensed up about how important it is to make the next play. And on one level, it's not even actually that helpful to be like all tensed up, like, and trying that hard. But and then the other level is like giving myself permission to kind of slow down and pull back. And like, it's okay to give 80% right now in this moment, in this situation. And
yeah. Yeah. How did you learn that? How did you learn that it's okay to give the 80%? I'm asking because I know for a lot of people I work with, and also in my own life, that wasn't automatic, right? I had to learn that. But I'm curious, how did you learn that?
It's a good question. I don't know. Probably, I'm trying to give you an honest and authentic answer. And I don't even know if I know. I guess maybe part of it is just learning the consequences of not doing it, just sort of hitting a lot, finding these recurring patterns where I end up feeling burnt out. And when I'm able to sort of reflect on what leads to that sense of burnout, it's because I'm just pushing too hard on the gas in life in all these different areas. And so just learning that in order to attend to all these different parts of my life that I find valuable, it's maybe unsustainable to always be giving 110% in everything all the time. And you just kind of learn from experience.
That's true. I think, yeah, I hear you. I think for me, it has been a little bit like that too, like learning by doing, right? Noticing that the more that I work harder and harder, I'm going to feel much more tired, much more fatigued, that actually my energy is going to decrease the next day. But having reset times, right, actually helps me to be much more productive, to be much more engaged, right? But I think that is something that, yeah, you know, some of us will learn by doing. One of the approaches also I like to present to my clients is the difference between maximizing and satisfying. And this is coming from the world of the theories of decision making. It is very common that high achievers want to maximize every single thing they are doing. They have to be the best at this. If they're going to buy a TV, it has to be the best TV possibly, right? So a behavior to manage that will be searching for hours, asking other people, going to the store. And then optimizers in general, they will make a good enough decision because they know if something goes wrong, they will figure out later on. So I think one of the micro skills is to distinguish, is this situation or does this situation requires a maximization process? Do I have to maximize this or can I just do that good enough and optimize? Right. Yeah. So that is one question I invite my clients to check. Right. Do we really, really have to optimize this? or do we have to maximize it? Let's check a little bit. Because the mind will tell us that you have to maximize everything, make the best possible decision, make the best choice, make choices that you don't regret. Again, it's chasing something that is not unattainable, right? But learning to unpack a little bit our own urges is another way of learning this discrimination.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, and then I find, you know, when I work with clients or even back looking on my own life journey at different times, the more we're stuck in that maximizing, putting so much of that extra level of energy into maximizing our decisions or how we live our lives, what ends up happening is the trade-off in that is there's just other parts of life that we're not even attending to at all with any type of intention or thought, because it has to come out somewhere. And so there's trade-offs in how much we in certain areas push towards that maximizing and other parts of our life that we're overlooking to sort of balance out that energy.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I'm smiling because certainly I had many moments like that in my life in which I was trying to maximize everything. I needed to research this. There is one time, and this is a true story, I have shared this in other settings, but a couple of years ago, I decided to buy a new TV. So this is maybe 7-8 years ago. And of course, right, I wanted to make the perfect choice, a choice that I don't regret, right? And wonderful Amazon Prime allows you to buy all types of things and to return them. So I researched on the different types of model, the different types of frames, you know, the qualities of the image, blah, 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 blah. I tortured all my friends. What about this? What about that? Right? Like, I was texting people. I went to the stores a couple of times. I bought 5 TVs. Was 5 TVs, and you know, my friends will come up, Patricia, say, like, I have to test them, you know. In fact, you should be helping me to test these images. Do you see the colors? Do you see the shades? What about the light on, the light off? And this is a case in which I was certainly trying to maximize the best decisions, right, when buying a TV. And of course, it was absolutely annoying having to wrap every TV, drag it, and bring it back to the store to return them, right? It actually cost me so much more time and effort and physical energy, right? Yeah. But that is one example in which how sometimes our urge to make the best choice, our urge to maximize, lead us to these unworkable behaviors, right? Yeah. I have a wonderful TV, and people ask me, Patricia, did you notice the difference between that model and the other options? And I laugh when I say, well, sometimes yes, sometimes no, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it helps you feel better about all that time you put into it.
Yeah. But that's an example of, it's a very, you know, perhaps micro example of how these maximizing behaviors may look like, right? Imagine if you engage in those behaviors more often than not in your life.
Yeah.
It's really not sustainable, right?
Yeah.
But it happens certainly.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we're so zoomed in on a decision like that, the importance of it is so amplified. And when we're in the midst of it, it feels, yeah, so critical to those differences between the 5 TVs feel so critical and important to get right. But then once that wave passes and we make a decision and we come out on the other side and you reflect back 6 months to a year later, you realize how minimal those differences often are. But in the moment when we're caught up in it, it feels just so critical to get it right.
That's right. It's like a life decision, right? And one of the things that happens when you think about decision making and maximization versus optimization processes is that people who are prone to deeply care for what they do, high achievers, people engaging in perfectionistic behaviors, strivers, they struggle making choices because they are afraid of the regret. You know, what if I regret this choice? They are afraid that they won't be able to handle a negative outcome, right? And they start second guessing themselves. And they are also afraid that the outcome will be worse than it actually could be, right? So those three variables, right, actually can keep you into this analysis paralysis when making choices, the fear of regret, the fear that it will be too much, I won't be able to handle this. And this anticipation that the outcome is going to be terribly, terribly wrong, yeah. right? It's going to be awful. So that is very common also if you, when you're working with clients with perfectionistic behaviors, those three micro fears kicking in that leads them to analysis paralysis.
Yeah. Regret is something a lot of people struggle with when, and this is just validating your point. Yeah, I've noticed that when you get inside people's worlds who struggle with some of these decision-making, analysis, paralysis, regret is such a big part of that, that people are trying to avoid. And it's kind of unavoidable because as soon as you invest any amount of time into making a decision, you're automatically setting yourself up to sort of regret it or feel disappointed on some level. And it's kind of like one of my favorite albums. One of my favorite musicians is Elliott Smith, and he has an album called Either Or, and it's based off of the Kierkegaard book, Either Or. Anyway, I think from what I remember from kind of trying to make my way through that book many years ago, it was part of that is acknowledging how in any type of decision, either you do this or you do that, your brain is going to sort of make you think about the side that you didn't choose and sort of make you feel like you made the wrong decision. And so really, whenever you get to any type of choice point, the more that you invest in making the right decision, you're sort of setting yourself up psychologically to feel regret about the other side, because we don't get to see how that really plays out.
Yeah. That is so true. You know, I think that the moment that we commit to something, the moment that the mind makes a second guess, but what about this other choice? What about option B and option C, right? And one of the micro skills that I teach my clients among many is that tough choices require kindness, right? That the moment that we choose something, whether you are maximizing or optimizing, let's expect that your mind will question the choice once again.
Yeah.
But when you commit to something, you're making yourself a personal promise. I will stick to this, you know, for X amount of time in some decisions. I will stick to this, not knowing the outcome exactly. And I'm also going to make room for the grieving process that is going to come from saying no to this other thing. I think, especially when people, again, that are prone to deeply care, like high achievers, they care about many areas in their life. They're very attuned with their values, right? So quite often they're facing difficult dilemmas, right? Do I show up to my kid's soccer game, or do I go out with my partner on a day? Do I work in this book that I want to work, or do I go to hang out with my friends? These areas are very important in their life. But committing to one of them means grieving that I say no to something that matters to me as well. Right? Yeah. And I think that is a tough choice and requires kindness to manage that I did the best choice that I could in this moment, which is not easy, right? When you're prone to deeply care about things.
Yeah, it's a good thing to just embrace, though, and get on the right side of, to recognize that in every decision, there's also a decision to say no to other things. And if you can see that as just part of the process of life and something to embrace rather than a problem or something to fight against, it's really helpful, because anything, and that's probably why people struggle the bigger the decision gets, you know, the TV, that's an expensive, it's a bigger item, but then you work your way up to people can struggle, like the person you're going to marry. That's one of the big ones that can really, when you're saying yes to one person, you're saying no to lots of other people and
that's
a job
right.
or a home. This shows up in all of those types of situations, and it's something that you can learn to get on the harmonious flow of that rather than trying to fight upstream against it.
That's right. And I think that requires this, that's what I think tough choices require, is kindness with ourselves, right? Because it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to say no to the other people that you were dating. It's going to be hard to say no to the people you were working with, or to say no to a job offer, right? And I think that's why, you know, self-compassion skills are super important, right? For all of us, right? For all of us. But in particular, I think for high achievers, because this fear of being a failure, it's a very strong fear. It's historical. It's not a fear that has been present just one day or, you know, in their adult life. Usually when I work with my clients, I map, right, how the fear of being a failure has shown up in their life at different times when they were children, when they were teenagers, when they were older adolescents, in their young adult. And what you have is that they have different experiences in which this fear was like, you know, for some of them it's like a phobia, right? They distinguish this fear from any other fears, right? The possibility of being a failure socially, the possibility of being socially rejected. It's always there, right? So I think that it's courageous to walk with a mind that is prone to deeply care, and knowing that the world will disappoint us, knowing that we will disappoint others. I think self-compassion skills are extremely important in our life, but in particular in those moments when we're grieving the gap between how things are supposed to be or we want them to be and how things are, or the choices we have to make.
Mm. Yeah, it's like it draws attention to some of these really old, ancient ideas, philosophical ideas, you know, like in Buddhism, just how the root cause of suffering through one interpretation is around, really comes down to just expecting the world to be different than it is, right? And that's something that's inherent in a lot of these fears of failure that come up. It's like there's a part of us that was expecting it this to be different than it is, and it causes this suffering.
Yeah. It's a very, you know, I always think about this. In fact, this morning I was reading about this because I think it's a different type of pain in some way, right? When you leave this reality gap, when things are not as you wish them to be, when you make choices that you regret later on, how do we nourish a sense of self that is transcendent? Mm. I think it's something that it always helps me to have rich conversations in my work, but also in my own life, right? How do we deconstruct this ego that gets overly fused with accomplishments, achievements, and how things are supposed to be? How do we develop our sense of identity beyond accomplishments or our failures or mistakes, right? I think it's a process. It's not easy, and it's something that I'm always thinking about, right? How we can nourish that in different ways.
Yeah, totally. It's extremely valuable, and it's something you have to sort of cultivate from the inside out. And it's not even maybe you cultivate it, you have to like reconnect with it, because I think we're all connected to that transcendent sense of self when we're babies, and then we sort of lose it or it gets clouded up. But when we can when you can connect with that more secure home base inside, I find that no matter what's happening, whatever failure or embarrassment or difficult situation is happening, there's always this place inside where it feels secure on like the deepest level. There's like a vantage point to watch all of that stuff, even when it's really painful. And maybe before I reconnected with that place, each time one of those things showed up, you feel like you're just kind of being thrown around into it. And you lose that broader perspective inside that's watching it all play out. And so, and I think once you kind of cultivate that place, it doesn't really go away too, which is cool. It's not like going to the gym and getting in good shape and then you stop going and you get out of shape. That place you can connect to, that more spiritual awareness observer inside, I feel like once you really build connection to it, it stays too. At least I found in my experience.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head as you are speaking, because I can see, and I'm just thinking about my own life, right? There have been times in my life in which I was chasing things that I shouldn't have chased, right? I have many, many moments like that. And I remember one of them in which I really, through ACT, of course, right? I think my life is before ACT and after ACT, right? So that's my life. It's like a telenovela.
Like many,
right? Before and after ACT, right? But it was actually one of the annual conferences. I remember I was participating in a workshop. Then I was looking to my own stuff. And I remember asking myself deeply, what am I really chasing? What am I really trying to avoid here, right? And I realized how much I was trying to, in some way, avoid rejection, how I was trying to, in some way, prove that I am competent to a group of people that didn't have a space for me, right? And that is, you know, as part of unpacking that, I promised myself that I will create the new for myself, the new that works for me. And that's what I have been doing the last couple of years, right? But it wasn't that I was losing perspective because I deeply wanted to be seen by the crowd that didn't want to see my work. They didn't take me serious. They ignored my work as much as they could, right? So I was hurting so much that the way that I was managing my pain is by trying over and over to prove myself to them that I'm competent as they are. Who knows why I was doing that? I think I know, but I was never there. But I think when I had clarity of what I was chasing, I also had clarity about what I needed to move. And it was a very sweet spot. It has been a sweet spot the last couple of years when I simply focus on this is the value and I will create content for that without knowing how it's going to go, right? And that sweet spot, right? Of course, sometimes it gets cloudy because our mind tells us all types of things, comparison thoughts, jealousy thoughts, right? All types of things. Second guessing ourselves. But if you go back to that sweet spot, when you have a clear sense, it's not demanding, it's not pushy, it's a very strong base and keep us going, right? It keeps us going. So I think that's what you're referring to, that we have that sense of that sweet spot that feels home for us. And from that place, it's like our own wisdom that we can make choices, right? And I think once we tap into that, we learn to go back to it. Right? It's experiential knowledge. And I think life has a very different flavor from that place.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and you're touching on the difference between being focused on outcomes versus the process, right? And you can feel that continually nourishing place even when we're working with clients. I totally relate to what you're saying in terms of how I've evolved in working with clients, where when I was like very green in the field and each session was like so taxing because there's such a part of us around needing to make change or have a certain outcome or to change. It's just like this push ahead to almost like force something good to happen at the end of the session or in this person's life. And then now it's like showing up from this just genuine open well of, I don't know, the now and the process of sitting there with a person. And it's such a different flavor, to use your terminology, of how I used to be in a room with a client versus now.
Wow, that's a powerful shift, right? Because I think a lot of us can relate to that, right? And how it is different, how we shop in the room with our clients from that place. That's really, really sweet. The other thing aspect I was thinking as we're talking about this, how we can nourish our true sense of self without being very hippy-dippy, right? I think at the end, it translates into a process of unlearning how we wish to be and accepting how we are. I think it's really, really a process, right? Of unlearning how I wanted to be, how I wish to be, this idealized version of myself, and accepting that this is who I am, right? I think that is something that was coming as you were sharing this and as we're talking about how to nourish this sense of identity.
Yeah, it really reminded me of something I read in an Alan Watts book, or he has a quote that in order to be who we are, we have to let go of who we think we are, or something
there
along
we
those
go.
Lines. Yeah, it's super. Yeah. It's a super powerful idea, because I think we all grow up with these, you know, ideas of who we are, who we're going to be one day, or the type of person we are, what we like, what we don't like, how we fit into the world. And those don't always end up playing out as our reality. And the more we hold on to that, the more we prevent ourselves from settling into the reality of who we are, for better or for worse.
That's right. That's very powerful, right? And I think that's when you think about unhelpful perfectionistic behaviors, that's where all the hustling, the doing more and more, over-preparing, over-searching kicks in, right? Because we're responding to this idealized version of the self. and a self that is trying to avoid feeling like a failure, right? But how will it be if we can tap into the sense of self that is wise, that acknowledges what's doable in a certain context, that acknowledges the complexities of living and wrestling with different important areas of our life, right? Quite different, right?
Yeah.
Quite different.
Yeah, and those attachments of who we think ourselves to be can be a full range of positive to negative, for lack of better terminology, where, you know, my personal journey was learning how to sort of let go of the ideas of how, like, good I was in these different ways and settling into maybe the parts that were more vulnerable about, you know, more of those, you know, painful parts of myself or parts I didn't like about myself, where for other people, they can be really attached to ideas of how bad they are and open, and they have to allow themselves to open up more to the beauty inside of them. So I don't know. And I guess to be fair, we probably all do both sides of that, but I guess the point is it can go to either end of the spectrum of both getting overly identified with the good, quote unquote good and quote unquote bad parts of us.
That's right. I think it's true. I think sometimes we get overly fused with that, right? We're over-identified. And that's why if I think about ACT processes, perspective taking, making context-based decisions versus, rigid-based decisions are important in our work, right? Because it really helps us to hold the complexity of reality. But that's not easy. I think it's a process. I think in my life hasn't happened from one day to another day. It hasn't been like one ACT workshop and that was it, right? Mm. It's all the time just working through them. And I think with our clients, it's really the same, right? Just checking which part of us is observing and which part is the doing and trying to do more and more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super useful to be able to step back and see it from that broader point of view.
I think it's very, very important, right? You know, if you ask me in my work with high achievers, I think that's the hardest part. How to nourish this, how to unpack this ego that, you know, it's trapped to doing things in a particular way, and how to nourish more this transcendent ego that is not attached to the outcomes, that is not attached to chasing. And I don't use those terms in the, you know, when I'm working with clients, but in the back of my mind, that's really what I am thinking of, right? How we really come back and reconstruct in some way our own sense of identity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough with clients because at least from my own experience personally, and then working with clients, it's not something you can, be talked into, you know, it's something you have to experientially touch and allow water and allow it to grow. And, I think there's a lot of roads into doing that. But it's maybe especially when we're new to ACT, and you're trying to do it out, it's so easy to like talk about ACT and talk about these things versus doing it. And this is one in particular that you can't really talk somebody into experiencing a more transcendent sense of self.
I agree. You know, that's true, right? That is true. I think the beauty of ACT certainly is that, you know, we're cultivating the experiential learning, right? But I think this developing a different sense of self is certainly involves this process of unlearning and sometimes grieving. Yeah. Grieving that I was craving to be this, to be, you know, to perform this, to get this outcome. But this is what the reality is, right? It's grieving the gap a little bit, right? A process, certainly a process, not a one-time session or something like that.
Yeah, maybe if you... maybe if you're taking psilocybin mushrooms or something. Maybe I'll edit that out, but no, because it's a part of our, I think the future of mental health, of like our work with treatment. I think there's like these tools that we can use to help people tap that place in supportive, safe ways that can be really powerful and support that process for people. I think that's one of the main benefits that we're finding clinically out of the use of psychedelics and therapy.
That, you know, I have attended a couple of presentations on psychedelics. I am not up to date in all the research, but I have asked the question if there is any research looking at the impact of psychedelics in cognitive rigidity, because I think quite often sometimes I encounter in my work clients who are holding onto white knuckles to these beliefs, like really, really. And, you know, you can look at the workability, the long-term consequences. You can try to do all types of creative hopelessness moves, right? But the mind is very strong. You know, those thoughts are very, very reinforced. And I'm curious, some people have mentioned that there is, I think, two papers in which they were looking at some shift in cognitive rigidity with psychedelic treatments. But that is something that I am very, very curious about, right? Because at the end, what we have is cognitive rigidity with a sense of self, right? This strong attachment, what we call infusion with the story of not being good enough, of being a failure, right? It is, I think, for some clients, it's hard to make the shift. And perhaps, you know, psychedelic treatments have an alternative to that.
Yeah. It just can really, directly used in the right way with the right support, kind of loosen so much of that tight fusion and those really hardened pathways in the mind and give people an opportunity to see themselves and think in new ways and have new ways of new perspective. And I think there's so much, there's a whole frontier out there that I'm excited. I hope things keep moving in this direction that they are in applying psychedelics clinically.
It looks like that, right? I'm always thinking about Sam Harris. A couple of years ago, he lives in the Bay Area, but he did an event in which Sam Harris interviewed Yuval Harari. Mm-hmm. The Israeli historian, and it was a very, very juicy interview, as I will say. I was so happy there just watching, right? But I always think of Sam Harris as a person that has been very, very outspoken about his experience with psychedelics and how he has experienced this really humongous shift in his life, right? Yeah. Of how he experienced himself. And so I think there is something there that hopefully in a couple of years we're going to understand much more than what we know now.
Yeah. And hopefully more and more we feel able to speak more freely about that without so much like fear and paranoia about the sort of maybe the unjust paradigm we live in around this stuff. Not that these things are a panacea or don't have any risk, but I think it's been unfairly maligned, right? And we're slowly trying to loosen that up.
I think it seems to be that we're in a time of transition, right? I think there is still the stigma, the fear, the concern, and that makes sense given our context, right? But it does seem that the last 10 years that the number of studies in psychedelics is exploding, right? And we're seeing much more the research coming out. So I think also that is changing the narrative, right? It's changed the narrative, how we relate to these new alternative treatments, right? Yeah. So I am personally, I want to keep following the research and see what is out there. The aspect I'm interested in is what we're talking, right? What happens when a person has a strong fuse with these very, very sticky beliefs, right? How psychedelic treatments can help them.
Yeah, totally. Well, this time flew by. It was lovely talking to you.
So quick. Thank you.
Would you want to share how people can connect with you?
Well, the time went so fast. My goodness. Thank you for having me again. These days, I am hanging out on Instagram. Believe it or not, I have a very interesting relationship with social media. But I am on Instagram. I think my handle is drz.behaviorist. Of course, I have to have something related to behaviorist. And then my website is www.thisisdrz.com. I have a weekly newsletter. I call it Playing It Safe. And I am regularly sharing ACT skills, ACT micro skills for all types of anxiety struggles. I write, I sometimes share some random thoughts, I have some interviews. So it's always fun. And if people want to learn more ACT for anxiety, I think that's a good source.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a treat.
Thank you. Thank you. It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep when the entire world kept feeding on my greed.
I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Yes, I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Oh, yes, I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul.